morning and welcome to the MERS Monday podcast. As you can tell, I'm not Kyle Mullen. I'm Emily Lawler here with MERS News, and we've got John Rurink, Craig Mauger, and our guest Dennis Denno this morning. First, we're going to talk a little bit about Mitt Romney coming to town. What's on his agenda?
He's going to be promoting some Republican candidates. David Trott is one. Who else is he coming out for?
Coming out for Bill Schuette, yeah.
So we'll see if his stock has gone up. Obviously, these are Republican primaries, so he's going to help them. Well, not Schuette's really a primary, but in the case of Trott, it'll help him gain some visibility, certainly. He's probably still held in high regard among those Republican primary voters. So.
Now, Romney didn't fare so well here during the presidential campaign. He made his gaffe about a couple of Cadillacs on Ford Field. He took a little bit of flack for talking so often about the trees being the right height. Is him coming really a help here at this point, Craig?
I mean, I think if you're David Trott, it's a benefit in some ways that, I mean, it's going to get him some headlines, probably some big headlines in some of the key newspapers. It's going to make him look like a credible candidate. I mean, he's trying to run against somebody who is the incumbent. And I think this gives Trott maybe a step forward to say, you know, look at me, look at how high of a level I am at, and look how well known I am. I've got a former presidential candidate coming to help me. So I think in some ways, yes, it does help him.
Who would be on your wish list for someone to come to headline a fundraiser, or another maybe governor, or who else would help definitely in any Republican primary?
See, the problem with making that pick as a Republican is you start dividing up the Tea Party interests, and you're going to wind up alienating somebody. The good thing about Mitt Romney is, if you think about a post-presidential campaign, his stock's actually going up. I mean, the Netflix film about him made him more human. I think he's sort of transitioned away from candidate Mitt Romney to sort of more like a senior, neutral almost character. You can't use John McCain because that would divide the Tea Party. You can't use, go down the list, there's a lot of Republicans you could pick, but there are very few that you don't want to go total to Tea Party, but it's a tough thing to pick. I would think Mitt Romney would be right up there.
Do his Michigan roots go deep enough where people consider him kind of one of us?
I think older people might. I don't know if younger folks would. What about a John Engler? Bringing a John Engler out.
You could.
Yeah.
You could.
He's still got a lot of political acumen.
He's got a lot of acumen. He's got a lot of influence in the state. That wouldn't be a bad choice.
I mean, if your goal is to bring someone out who's going to create buzz and get a lot of attention, I think Chris Christie would get a lot of attention. He got a lot of attention when he was campaigning for land. I'm guessing Rand Paul would get a lot of attention. I don't know if that would be necessarily the intention that every Republican candidate would want. Marco Rubio would get attention, I'm sure.
But at the same time, Benevolio brought Boehner out, and it didn't seem like that did get a lot of buzz.
Well, that was kind of an issue of Benevolio's audience is more of a Tea Party audience, and doesn't really make a lot of sense to bring someone who the Tea Party really doesn't like that much to support a Tea Party candidate. So the Trott Romney thing seems to work pretty well, I guess.
Yeah, it does. I mean, if you think on the national scale for Republicans, you couldn't bring George Bush in, really. That doesn't do you much. Good. Chris Christie's controversial. I mean, a lot of these characters have, I think overall, even though Mitt Romney didn't win, he didn't take this state, but then again, nobody's taken the state since George Bush Sr. He's still kind of become that senior, more neutral figure out of the Republicans right now.
Yeah, but the question too is, this is a fundraiser. So who can you bring in to raise money and maybe get you a headline as opposed to help build your base and support? If Romney works, it's great. Great for them.
Definitely. Well, we're going to turn over to you, Mr. Denno. You ran an insider poll. Tell us about some of the results and how people think the Senate and gubernatorial campaigns are doing.
Yeah, so we did a, Denno Research did a survey with MERS Newsletter. We asked MERS subscribers what they thought of the four statewide campaigns to rank the campaigns. And 62% gave the Snyder campaign high marks. He did the best out of the four campaigns. Then came Gary Peters coming in at 49%, Terry Lindland at 31%, and Mark Schauer only came in at 15%. People thinking his campaign's doing well.
So what do we make of that? Is there somewhat of a dynamic here? Obviously, Governor Snyder and Congressman Gary Peters both hold office already. Are people just kind of putting the momentum behind them because they're already halfway there or all the way there?
I think people are picking winners. I think maybe you can make the argument that right now that Snyder and Peters have better messaging for their campaigns. I think one of the interesting things I took away from this, and I've taken away from the polls we've done of voters, is that Schauer really needs his Democratic base to come home. And even in our MERS survey, people who self-identified themselves as Democrats were more likely to give Peters high marks than they were to give Schauer's campaign high marks.
Mm-hmm. What is the statewide percentage in the polls you've looked at as far as, so you said Democrats need to come home? If he had all the Democrats right now, what would we be looking at as far as?
Oh, I think Schauer would be much more competitive. I mean, I would think, you know, the state is arguably 42% Democratic, 38% Republican, roughly off the top of my head. But Schauer still needs to work on wooing his base, and it's not too late. He still could, but you know, the problem is it's a gubernatorial year. Democrats are less likely to come out to vote. I mean, it's interesting that a lot of Democrats are hoping that. The Peters for Senate campaign is the campaign that actually brings Democrats out to vote, which is kind of interesting.
If you were advising the Schauer campaign, we're tomorrow, I guess, is what, July 1? When does that window close for them to start getting the message across, to start getting the base excited? Is it August? Is it? I mean, obviously summer kind of everybody tunes out, but
I would wake up
and it's August 15th, you're not that far away from the election, really.
Right. I mean, I would say, you know, after Labor Day, you're starting at, you know, which is whatever, September 5th, 6th. I mean, you know, you really need to start having a message that's going to get people out there excited about you and excited about voting for you and volunteering for you.
In the Peters land matchup, how much damage do you think her performance on Mackinac Island did to her numbers among people who sort of are our subscribers who are in our sphere?
I still hear people talking about it. It's pretty amazing. I mean, she really, really hurt herself, and I think a lot of people are just waiting for her to make the next gaffe. And the problem for her, now everything becomes skewed. Everyone's waiting for her to screw up. Everyone's going to look at her with this filter and just pick her apart, which is can be really damaging.
What about who had the highest number of people who thought, you know, rated their campaigns doing really poorly? Was that also Schauer?
Schauer had the worst ratings. At only 15% thought he was doing, his campaign was doing well.
Right. Gotcha. And, you know, 59% of the respondents to this poll were Republicans, 24% Democrats, 17 undecided or not affiliated. How does that affect what people might be thinking about these races?
Sure, it definitely helps skew the numbers in favor of Republicans, but even so, I mean, more people thought Gary Peters was doing well or his campaign was doing better than Terry Lynn-Land's campaign. I mean, we need to be a little careful with this survey. I mean, we're asking people to self-identify themselves. It's not a necessarily scientific sample.
Right.
So.
Gotcha. Well, what does it say? Are people thinking more on the voting more on individuals than by party? I mean, is that what this shows? If in the two biggest races, a Democrat's up in one and people think their campaign is doing better, and a Republican's up in one and the people think their campaign's doing better?
Yeah, no question. I mean, we never even identified them as Democrats or Republicans. I mean, people know what they are, but we never identified their party affiliation. I think they're just doing an honest assessment of the campaigns as they see them.
Interesting.
Yes. It seems like there is a little bit of picking winners and losers here. Have you mentioned it seems like there'd be a lot of that. I mean, Snyder's up. Snyder's doing well. Peters is up, and he's doing well. But, I mean, I think that Schauer number is interesting. How much of a role do you think the fact that he just hasn't been able to really get his name out there and really had a lot of success in letting people know who he is? Whenever polls come back, a lot of times there's a huge chunk of people who are like, I don't even know who this guy is yet. I mean, do you think that plays a role here?
Yeah, I think it plays a huge role. It's just that Mark Schauer's a great guy. He's a great congressman, but he came from mid-Michigan, and that's part of his problem. People in Metro Detroit don't know who he is. And so he's got to overcome that and really sell himself to a large chunk of the state.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing we should probably note about this survey is these are people that are inside the Beltway.
Right.
That have been reading every single story or lack of story, and that the population as a whole really isn't that tuned in yet, are they?
No, I mean, the population as a whole are not tuned in. And, you know, in Mark Schauer's defense here, when we do polling on statewide voters, I mean, Snyder's numbers aren't great either. I mean, he's not at over 50% in the surveys. His approval ratings aren't over 50%. So, I mean, it's not like Snyder's walking away with this.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, and thanks for coming on the MERS Monday podcast, first-time victim. So.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right. Well, we're joined here by Matt Gillard, president and CEO of Michigan's Children, and this group is actively pushing the Sandbox Party, which sounds way more fun than the Democratic or Republican Party. Maybe some castles involved, but tell us what this is all about.
Well, the Michigan Sandbox Party has really started as a grassroots effort of early childhood advocates around early childhood issues. We've kind of expanded it now to cover cradle to career children's issues. And we're really focused at this point on this upcoming election. Obviously, this is a critical election in Michigan with our entire legislature up and the governor's races and some open congressional races for the first time in a long time and an open U.S. Senate seat. And so really, right now, we're trying to encourage people to get engaged and get involved in this election and get people to understand that even, you know, especially this August primary election, a lot of critical decisions will be made, decisions that will impact children and families here in Michigan for years to come.
What are you sensing from people you're out there talking to about what the, you know, interest level is in this primary? Are people more interested than in past years, less interested? Are they apathetic? What's going on?
I would, unfortunately, I think it's probably about the same as in past years where we haven't seen, you know, really low turnout. I mean, part of that, I think, is driven by the fact as well that we don't have active primary races at the top of the ticket, you know, where in years past we have had active primary races at the top of the ticket. I think we're just trying to get the word out, get the message out to folks that these decisions, you know, these legislative races, these districts have been drawn so partisan on both sides of the aisle that, you know, most of these races are going to be decided in August. And if we can get more people who care about kids and care about kids' issues to vote in August, I think we'll be better off.
How's that supposed to, you know, how does that guide you? In which direction, I guess, would you say, you know, if I care about kids, what are some characteristics of a candidate that I would support?
Well, I think you want to see what the candidates are saying. I mean, you know, and whether it's children's issues or anything else, I mean, if what's important to you is what is important to these candidates, then it's probably somebody that you're likely to support. You know, I think a bigger challenge, frankly, for us as a child advocacy organization is everybody talks about kids during the campaign, right? They all want to, you know, be the pro-education or the pro-child or the pro-family legislators, but then actually holding their feet to the fire when they come here to do their job is a different story. But, you know, you can certainly tell where candidates' priorities are by the information that they put out there themselves, you know, throughout this process.
Talk a little bit about Michigan's Children. You said you've been there 2-3 months. Talk about the history of the group, where you'd like to take it, where you see it going.
Well, Michigan's Children is the leading nonprofit child advocacy organization here in Michigan, focused on children's issues from cradle to career. The organization has been in existence for over 20 years. I think has a strong reputation in the state of being a nonpartisan voice for kids. And a resource for folks who want to get involved, either in the political process or in the legislative process, or just to you know, stay informed on what's happening around children's issues here in Lansing and in Washington, D.C. I certainly want to help continue that work, grow upon it, and keep making sure that children's and families' issues are an important part of the discussion here in Lansing and in Washington, and that you know, legislators, elected officials are able to connect with people in their districts that care about these issues.
If kids could vote, would the state of education in the state be better?
I like to think so. I mean, that's one of our slogans, I would say, or mottos, is kids can't vote, so you should. but I think it would be an interesting dynamic, certainly.
Well, you're no stranger to K-12 budgets, from what I hear.
Yes.
You know, what kind of marks do you give the legislature on the school bus budget, as we've been calling it this go-around?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a mixed bag. You know, I think it depends on what perspective you're coming from. Like, for instance, myself, I was a big supporter of equity. I think this budget is fairly strong in making the equity case and trying to get some more funding to those underfunded school districts. You know, that's a position when I chaired the budget that I pushed for as well, because my district benefited from that. You know, I represented a number of lower funded rural school districts in northern Michigan. And similarly, I think, you know, you saw that play out this year as well. Certainly the early childhood increase, a second year in a row of another $65 million for pre-K, that really puts Michigan at the forefront nationally of investing in a quality preschool experience for, you know, all four-year-olds should have an opportunity at a quality preschool experience here in Michigan. And that's tremendous. I mean, that's going to help our educational system for years to come. The research and the data is clear that if we can get kids access, kids most at risk of school failure, access to quality pre-K, we're in a much better position for years to come. On the other hand, there's certainly some, some other things included in the budget maybe that aren't as positive. I think, you know, in light of even the recent charter school investigation or whatever we want to call it that's come out through the Free Press, I think there's a real interesting discussion and debate that needs to happen about accountability and transparency and on what we're doing from a funding, state funding standpoint, from a competitiveness angle. You know, I mean, it's simply the where we are at from a regulatory standpoint is not, I think there's a real issue on what the state is doing from a regulatory standpoint and making school districts be able to compete in this environment.
Well, what are some, I mean, is there a budget fix that would bring charter schools kind of in line in transparency, more language that could be added? You know, what would be some solutions?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know that I have the silver bullet, but I think it's a part of the budget process needs to be discussed in this frame as well. But I think there are policy changes as well. I mean, the simple fact that the charters don't have to offer busing or even offer high schools. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I could start a traditional K-12 school right now, and I didn't have to do busing, and I only had to go K-8, you know, with even a minimum foundation allowance, I think that you could, you know, make a strong argument that you could build a decent school system and compete effectively. But that's just not the case, right? Our K-12s have to go K-12. They have to provide transportation. There's a disadvantage, there's a built-in disadvantage in the system right now that I think needs to be addressed if we truly want to continue to have strong K-12 school systems.
So you think an equal playing field would kind of help the free market argument for charter schools?
Yes, I think it's hard. I think it's hard with a straight face to say that you're supporting this free market argument when you're not. I mean, you're creating a disparate system of regulations or expectations even. And I think it presents a real challenge. And I mean, I think where that comes out at the forefront is obviously through the budget. I mean, that's the biggest issue that K-12 schools deal with on an annual basis. But so I think there's both budgetary fixes potentially and regulatory changes that could help help address those situations.
Are there any charter schools or charter school programs that you'd like?
Yeah, I'm not anti-charter. I mean, I think there are wonderful charter schools. I mean, clearly. And clearly, there's a need for them. You know, I mean, there's a market there. There's people that are not happy with the traditional K-12 schools in a lot of their communities, and so there's a, you know, there's certainly a role for charters to play. I think that the state has to get serious, the legislature and the governor has to get serious about how they're going to address the educational needs for all children and create a framework where, I mean, if we want free market competition in education, that's fine, but let's make it competitive, and let's make it advantageous to all who are offering educational services to kids.
You mentioned the issue of equity in K-12 funding. As a former budget chair, do you see any risk in going down this path where lawmakers are voting for this budget based on how their schools do alone and not looking at it from a grander statewide picture? Because we saw this with the last budget. The lawmakers who voted for it, their schools got more. Lawmakers voted against them, their schools got less. Is there any risk in going down that path?
I think there probably is some risk, but I think that's not new. When I chaired the budget, it was the same way. We kind of reignited this 2X debate or this equity debate, and we saw a split in support for the K-12 budget amongst party on both sides. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had Republicans voting for the school aid budget and voting against it. We had Democrats voting for it and against it. It caused problems in the caucus with some caucus dynamics. Mm-hmm. But I don't. I mean, in that regard, I think it's democracy and it's our democratic system probably working better than it often does. I mean, I think we have more. I have more of an issue if all we're seeing passed are straight party line votes or partisan mm-hmm. budgets and other things. So I think inherently there's a challenge with that. I think, you know, maybe the answer is if we truly get to a place of equity, then that's no longer an issue. Then we may have debates about what, you know, particular programs are funded and which ones aren't. But if we're at a place where the state funding for a K-12 student is the same in Grosse Pointe as it is in Alpena, then I don't think we have that equity funding debate anymore. But we're not there yet, obviously.
What do you think about this debate that keeps playing out against Snyder over whether education funding has gone up or down? I mean, what is your thoughts on that question?
I think, this is politics, and it's an election year. I mean, I think you can argue it both ways. I think both sides have argued it successfully both ways, right? I mean,
which way would you argue it?
Can I argue it both ways?
I would agree with Governor Snyder that state funding support for K-12 education has gone up under his watch. And I think that's the fundamental basis of his argument, and he's correct in that. But I think, you know, the Democratic side of overall funding for K-12 education has gone down in the state. I think it's true also. But, you know, there's a federal component to that that's built in. I think the question ultimately boils down to, and this is what's great, I think, about budgets in election years, is, you know, the public gets to pay attention and can decide whether or not they agree with what, you know, this budget does. And this is an issue that people care about. I mean, K-12 education and their public schools are an issue that people care about. And so I think it's interesting to see the budget play out in an election year versus a non-election year. And this budget, I think people will be able to clearly determine whether or not they think the priorities of the governor and the Republican-led legislature meet theirs in terms of education funding.
It sounds like, though, you don't think that the decline in K-12 education can be hung on this governor.
I don't. I think that the Democrats will have a hard time if that's their sole message, is that the governor's cut education funding. I think that...
He's not to blame for the decline in education spending.
Yeah, in my opinion, no. I don't think that Governor Snyder is to blame for the decline in education spending.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us here on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you.
All right, and that's going to wrap it up for the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks for sticking around through the absence of our faithful editor, Kyle Malin, here. And our thanks this week goes out to John, who just returned from Africa. And John, thank you for the hippos that you brought us.
You're very welcome. We also have Malawi coffee from Mzuzu, Malawi. So.
That is an upgrade from Folgers. Yes. All right. Well, thanks so much, and tune in next edition of the MERS Monday podcast.